Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week we explore different aspects of the world of music, and that includes music history. So welcome to Follow the Sounds. This week in music history, we are going from November 20th through November 24th. Some good stuff happened. It'll probably be a pretty quick show because, well, not a lot of things happened, or at least not a lot of things that popped out to me and were like, yes, we need to absolutely talk about these. You know, when you start getting into these random things of like, oh, the Beatles played at this random club for the first time. And I'm like, I don't know what that club is. Like, I don't really care about like why they played there. Like, whoop-de-doo. It's not that big a deal. But to help me out tonight, I, of course, have my co-host, Jacob Grum.
I know not what may be coming, Brian, but be it what it will, I will go at it laughing.
I like that one, actually. What's that from?
Moby Dick.
Oh, there you go. So, on that note, let's go ahead and jump into a little bit of money first. And if you want to help us out, especially with Thanksgiving coming up right in this very week that we will be talking about, you know, with Black Friday coming around the corner, and then what do they call it? Cyber Monday, the following Monday, where they got all these great deals online. You can go on and you can shop on Amazon. But if you're going to shop on Amazon, go through our website. Go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that banner that's on the right-hand side for Amazon. That'll take you to Amazon. Do all of your normal shopping. Won't cost you anything extra to go through our site. But we get a little bit of money back. We get a little bit of a referral for percentage for everything that you purchase. So if you go out there and you buy all of your Christmas presents on Amazon, you know, however much that you spend, we get a small percentage of money back just for you going through our website. So you can go to the site, click on that banner, or you can just go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It is just that simple. If you're on our Facebook group too, you can go through there. I've posted a couple of links that link through there, which is, you know, an easy way to do it. But let us go ahead and get into this week in music history, starting with November 20th. And Jake, you have written a novel on the first one. What do you got?
Novels require more than one paragraph. This is a single paragraph.
That could just be, you know, poor grammar, but
either way, it would not change the fact that on this day, November 20th, in 1820, the whaling ship Essex is rammed and sunk by a whale in the South Pacific, later inspiring the song Nantucket Sleigh Ride.
All right, I was going to ask you how this was going to relate to music, because it's this week in music history, not this week in whaling history.
That is true.
Which wouldn't be a bad podcast to do, because I'm sure there's a few people out there who would really like that. But all right, continue.
Okay, and also, Brian, we have the beards for it.
Yes, we do. We look like whalers.
Right, so we could do what we could pull. All right, so the song Nantucket Sleigh Ride by the band Mountain was written about the whaling ship Essex. Now, in 1821, a book authored by the first mate of the Essex, Owen Chase, was called Narrative of the Most Extraordinary and Distressing Shipwreck of the Whale Ship Essex. In it, Mr. Chase gives his account of the Essex being attacked and sunk by a white whale. Does that sound familiar?
It does sound very familiar.
Mm-hmm. And how he and other survivors were stranded on rowboats some 2,000 miles east of Africa.
Wow. East of Africa.
Yes, in the South Pacific.
They were on the other side.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were in the Pacific, not the Atlantic.
Yes.
Yes. Somewhere south of Easter Island, actually.
Oh.
So, okay, so the Essex was struck on November 20th. However, it took the ship like 2 days to sink, so the crew was able to spend 2 days scavenging for supplies. What provisions they did gather were not nearly enough to maintain them for a 2,000-mile row to Africa.
Yes, because that's a long way.
It's a long way in a rowboat. However, what provisions they had gathered, weren't enough. After nearly 2 months at sea in rowboats, our author's boat became separated during a storm on the 11th of January. A second boat was sunk later in yet another storm. As the first mate, Mr. Chase, tells us, soon, one by one, the men began to die. By February, the first two men to succumb were buried at sea, as was the custom, sewn into their clothing, and then set adrift. However, soon the men had to resort to cannibalism to survive. And with the original crew being intact of two boats, it was down to one boat, right?
So, mm-hmm.
All right, so it started out with four, now we're down to one. By February 1st, only four men survived or were remaining. That was Captain Pollard, his 17-year-old cousin, Owen Coffin, and then two sailors named Charles Ramsdale and, I'm going to butcher this name because it's impossible to pronounce, Barzilly Ray. I'm going to call him Ray, Mr. Ray. The men's situation became even more dire when they had consumed all the bodies of what Mr. Chase called the unlucky men who died. Meaning that there were lucky, implying that there were lucky men that died. Get it?
Yes.
Okay. So it was decided that they should draw lots to determine who would be sacrificed for consumption. And as luck would have it, the subject of the song Nantucket Sleigh Ride, young Owen Coffin, drew the black spot. His cousin, Captain Pollard, pleaded with Owen to let him take his place. But Owen said, no, I like my lot as well as any other. Lots were then drawn to see who would be his executioner, and Mr. Ray drew that. However, several days later, Ray died. Excuse me, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Ramsdale was his executioner. And several days after killing Mr. Coffin, Mr. Ray died. And it was said that Pollard and Ramsdale survived by gnawing on the bones of Coffin and Ray. They were eventually rescued on, let's see, the, well, okay, 93 days. They were rescued 93 days after the ship was sunk by the whaling ship Nantucket. Now, our author, of course, also survived, and his boat fared much better, although they also had to resort to cannibalism. And they survived with six men on their rowboat, and they were rescued 89 days after. So, now, the most amazing thing, though, is that of the eight survivors, all but one of them lived to very old ages. And after Mr. Chase published his book, he went right back out to sea. In fact, all eight of them returned to whaling afterwards.
Wow.
Within a season.
Jeez.
And the man who lived the longest was boat steerer Benjamin Lawrence, who died at his home on Nantucket Island at the ripe old age of 80.
Wow.
So there you go. That was the inspiration for Moby Dick. So if anyone ever asks you, like, what Captain Ahab had against the whale that he never said, because that was, like, all subtext, he, like, would never talk about it, they made him kill and eat his cousin.
Yeah.
Pretty dark.
That's, yes. I mean, obviously, Moby Dick is one of those classic novels. And so, and everybody kind of knows that it was based on a real story, but... and in fact, they recently made a movie about it, like about the original like story, not the Moby Dick version.
No, we're not talking about the Patrick Stewart.
No.
Okay. Okay.
But it was recent. It was like last year or something when it was done. I believe it starred the Hemsworth, the Thor one.
Yeah, that guy.
And so. But it was supposed to be a really great movie. I just haven't seen it yet, so I'll get around to that one of these days. But that's kind of fascinating, though. That mm-hmm. I mean, Pollard. obviously, though, I mean, this entire thing has then spawned other stuff. I know mm-hmm. that there are tons of other songs out there that reference either Moby Dick, Captain Ahab, or something along those lines. But to actually have a song that actually references the real incident, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
The band Mountain?
Yeah.
Never heard of them before I came across this.
So, I also wanted to point out that Ahab is actually my gamer tag.
Yeah,
it is. And everybody is all like, Ahab the Arab. And I'm like, no, Captain Ahab.
Well, now you can also say the cannibal captain who shot his teenage cousin in the head.
There you go. But that wasn't Ahab. That was the other guy.
Captain Cannibal would probably be...
Captain Cannibal?
You should just change your...
That's going to be my Twitch streamer identity from now on. And
Captain
I'm just going to... Wanna have some like bone necklace that I'll wear? Yeah, it'll be good.
Oh, so you're just gonna steal like the boogeyman's the wrestler, the boogeyman's.
No, I'm gonna go like it's just gonna be a goofy character from that point on. So
anyhow.
Let's go ahead and, you know, you can do the next one, too, if you want.
I will.
So, and I'll take the last one for the
1970, Tom Waits gets his first ever paid gig, appearing as Thomas Waits and receiving $25 for opening for Michael Milliner and Claire Hart.
Nice. Good old $25.
There you go.
So, of course, we are fans here of Tom Waits. And we were actually just talking about the fact that the Tom Waits song was used in the new Punisher series.
Hell broke loose.
It was like the moment it started playing, I was like, this is Tom Waits. Like, I didn't even have to wait for the vocals to kick in. But yeah, no, we are fans of Tom Waits here on Follow the Sound. You can check out our review of what was the name of the album again, Jake, that we did?
We did Mule Variations.
That's right, Mule Variations, which was a fantastic one. And the fans of Tom Waits actually really, really liked our show. So good on those people for listening to our show. But let's go ahead and move on to the next one. And I actually did a little bit of research on this one, so that's okay, why then. I definitely wanted to do it. So 1973, The Who are, of course, playing they're playing a concert here in good old America, I believe. Let me just double check on that one real quick. So, yes, they were playing in the Cow Palace in San Francisco. I didn't know that place actually existed. And, you know, good way through the show, Keith Moon passed out. You know why he passed out? Because he took a horse tranquilizer and drank it with bourbon. A lot of bourbon, according to Pete Townsend. And so he passed out, then he came back on stage, played a song, and passed out again. So the incident goes that, let's see here, that Daughtry was like, you know, hey, does anybody out there play drums? And this one guy's friend all of a sudden starts going crazy and starts trying to get the attention of the band, saying, yeah, my friend does. And Pete Townsend actually goes, somebody good. And he's like, yeah, he's really good. And that's when Scott Halpin became a legend. Scott Halpin, of course, like, had been going through some stuff, apparently. He wasn't doing too well. He hadn't played the drums in a year.
Okay.
And but he was a good drummer. He was a decent drummer, at least at the time. And so he was a huge fan of The Who. Apparently they bought tickets from a scalper, showed up super early for general admission so they mm-hmm. could get like good placement. And so they got right up on that rail. And when they called out, it's like his friends going crazy saying, yeah, he can play the drums, get him up there. So they get him up there and he sits in there. Of course, this was after The Who actually played one song, like, without a drummer, and just were having a good old time with that one. So, then they get up there, and Scott actually sits down at the drums, and he's got to play with The Who. Apparently, he did a shot of bourbon to calm his nerves that the band offered him, and Townsend goes up to him and is just like, I'm going to lead, you just follow me. And he's like, okay! Let's do this. So he starts playing the first song, which was actually just a straightforward blues, which super easy. Any drummer can generally play a straightforward blues. Then they did Spoonful, which he had apparently a little bit of trouble with. And Townsend kept having to like turn back and like basically show him what he was doing. And then finished out the final song with Naked Eye. And apparently, though, he was ready for Naked Eye. Like he like knew this one by heart. So he rocks out on Naked Eye, and then they finish the set. He goes out there, takes a bow with the band, and then he and his friend got to go backstage and hang out with the group for a little while until eventually he found out the story about why Moon had passed out and just had a grand old time hanging out with the band.
And hence, horse tranquilizers has become a punchline.
Yes. Apparently, he was cool. John Entwistle, he said, was super cool. And, you know, everybody was really nice to him afterwards. I mean, they could have been just complete dicks, you know. But, hey, they let a random stranger go out mm-hmm. and play on their set for the last couple of songs. He got a concert jacket from them, which was stolen later that night.
Oh.
But everybody remembers this moment, and he has his own Wikipedia article, which is more than most men can say.
Also, only time this sentence, "Is there a drummer in the house," ever been uttered.
You know, it's funny, though, man. I've had those dreams.
With any degree of sincerity, anyways.
I've had those dreams, and I keep thinking about it. Like, there aren't many bands that I could legitimately, like, go in and fill in for. It's like, yeah, I know the songs, but I don't know them, like, that well. With the exception of anything Jamie Wolford has done. I could actually jump up on stage and play anything that he could throw at me from his repertoire. So there you go. That's the only band that I could do that with.
I thought I had my moment. Do you remember when we went to see the Phantom Menace?
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened that night?
Yes, the film broke.
No, the film did not break. The sound system melted down.
Oh, yeah. The sound system broke. That's what happened. So.
And a call went out, "Is there a sound man in the house?" And I offered my services, and I was turned down by what was a very weepy manager of the theater.
That wasn't a manager.
Okay.
That was like the president of the company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I found that out later on when I worked for the company. And I was like, "Hey, you're that guy." Like, he was a high-ranking dude. He wasn't just like some low-ranking manager. So it cracked me up when I actually got to meet him, and I was like, "Dude, I was there like that night that happened." And he goes, "Oh my God." He's like, "That was horrible." And I said, "We were fine. We were good. You got the movie back up and running. We were great." So everything was nice. Let's go ahead and move on to the next day, November 21st. I'll go ahead and do this one. 1846, the literary character Sweeney Todd makes his first ever appearance in the short story The String of Pearls, a romance. The story later becomes a musical complete with the song The Ballad of Sweeney Todd. There you go.
So were you aware that Sweeney Todd was a literary character and not just a part of the Johnny Depp musical?
I knew there was a reference to him before he became, you know, the demon barber of whatever street. I forgot the name of the street. So I knew that he was a reference, or that he was referenced in other stuff, but I didn't know exactly where that started. So there you go.
He was kind of a reoccurring villain in dime store novels.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I want to say that there were like some lawsuits that were filed over like people just straight up jacking the character.
Oh, makes sense.
But I don't know that for a fact.
You can go and do the next one.
Okay, yes. 1940. Ah, blues musician Dr. John is born Malcolm John Rebenack.
I'd say Rebenack,
yeah. Malcolm John Rebenack Jr. in New Orleans, Louisiana.
See, that man, like, honestly embodies the Louisiana blues man.
Doesn't he?
Just in the way he talks. And, like, the cool way he plays and the way he does the songs, man. Like, he's a fascinating character.
There was one night when I was somewhat drunk, and I kept going on and on about how I wanted to be a band leader. And you were like, "Jake, you can't be a band leader. You can't sing." And I said, "Well, Dr. John can't sing either." And your response is, "Well, he's Dr. John."
I actually remember that. That's funny. Oh, man.
"Y'all don't worry what the doctor say. I said a chocobo fit on there. Amen."
Happy birthday, Dr. John. 1960, the Beatles. George Harrison, just 17, is deported from Hamburg, Germany, where the group had been performing at the Kaiser Keller Club. And he was sent back to his native England. Historians typically blame the club's owner, Bruno Koschmeider, who may have tipped the authorities to George's age. The Beatles had broken his exclusive contract by playing at other venues, then returned to their rooms in one of his other venues and set it on fire in protest of being canned. So there you go. They got mad at him and set a room on fire in true rock and roll fashion. I guess I'll jump on to the next one, too. Why not? In 1965, Bjork I don't know how to say that, is born in Reykjavik, Iceland. After gaining acclaim in her group, the Sugar Cubes, she rises to fame as a solo artist using only her first name, Björk. That's all I got.
I'm going out on a limb here.
Go ahead.
Gaumudsudóttir.
Wow, that's pretty good, actually. Yeah, that's probably a lot closer than what I could have done. If anyone actually knows how to pronounce that, please contact us on Facebook with a phonetic spelling of that last name. You can find us at Follow the Sound Group on Facebook. Or contact us at Twitter at IFollowTheSound.
Here's what one of us will get it. This is just my this is just pet peeve of mine, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Icelandic names.
Mm-hmm.
Something bothers me. They have like 9 different ways of writing the letter O.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have an umlaut, half an umlaut, third of an umlaut? Is it an S set on top of an umlaut? Who knows?
I don't even try.
Anyway, Björk, really outstanding voice.
Yeah, she's always been good. She was really good in the Sugar Cubes, so.
Oh, yeah. They had, like, some anniversary concert last year.
Oh, did they?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It would have been nice to attend, however, it was in Iceland. You know, so.
Also, sorry for you folks who are hearing me cough. I am still getting over a cold. I should have mentioned that earlier so that way you aren't just like, well, is there somebody coughing in the background? That's because I'm getting over a cold. Sorry about that.
Here's something I'm not sorry about.
Go. You've been talking about this all freaking week.
Yes.
Go for it.
1986, Switched on Bach, an album of Moog synthesizers interpolations of classical compositions, becomes just the second classical album certified platinum by the RIAA. The album was released in 1969 by Walter Carlos, who in the late 70s became Wendy Carlos, and later went on to work with Stanley Kubrick and become his exclusive composer.
Wow. Now, I know that Switched on Bach has a very distinguished sort of, not title, but it is considered the first electronic album, right?
Yes. First off, it's the first like actual album released. It's not the first recording. It's not the first recording on vinyl.
Yeah.
But it's the first album release of any synthesizer, much less, you know, the Moog synthesizer.
Nice.
It kind of began the genre of electronic classical compositions, which is a very niche genre, to say the least. But
yes.
Anyway, well,
so here's kind of the cool thing I like about this.
Okay.
So Wendy went on to compose stuff for, like you said, Stanley Kubrick, which includes The Shining and Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
Funny side note, when we were in New York, they had a bunch of musicals and stuff like there, or not musicals, but Broadway plays. One of them was Clockwork Orange. And Jessica's like, "What's a Clockwork Orange?" And I was like, "You can't watch that." And she was like, "Why?" I said, "Because there's a lot of bad stuff in there." She was like, "Oh, okay." But here's the reason why I actually thought that this was pretty cool. So Wendy did the score for the first Tron movie.
Yes. Yes.
Which, in my opinion, is a superb soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the original Tron soundtrack is just amazing, like, soundscape of digital music. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. I even loved the updated one for the Tron movie that was made a few years ago. Like, the soundtrack to that movie was stupid good, but the movie was okay. So
yeah, it was,
because we saw that one together, actually. Yeah. We did. So that was one of the few ones we've actually gone like on whatever night and went and saw it ourselves.
So Wendy Carlos, huge fan. Huge fan of her. She's insanely, what's the word I'm looking for?
Talented?
Talented, but also doesn't do a lot of interviews.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, very shy in the public eye, but there's a very interesting interview that was done with her on right after Stanley Kubrick died.
Yes.
And it was all just on, there's probably 15 minutes in a documentary that have her, and she sits down on her Apple computer, and the same computer that she used to record and compose the Tron music and plays back the tracks off that original hard drive. Whole time the interview's being done, cat in the lap. Cat, she has a cat in her lap.
Yeah.
Like, for this. Anyway, you can find that on YouTube. It's worth just like her saying like weird little tidbits of, well, I decided to go with a sawtooth pattern here just because Stanley seemed to always like sawtooth patterns when I did that. So, like, I was stretching just to fill minutes here, and I wasn't sure what to do, so that just kind of became the go-to.
Funny side note about Wendy here is that in 1998, Carlos sued the songwriter artist Momus for $22 million for his song, Walter Carlos. From the album The Little Red Songbook, released that year, which postulated that the post-sexual reassignment surgery Wendy could travel back in time to marry her pre-surgery self, Walter. The case was settled out of court, and Momus agreed to remove the song from subsequent editions of the CD and owed $30,000 in legal fees. So, there you go. What a weird little story. Happy birthday!
Happy birthday? No, this is the album.
Oh, this is
talking about the album.
Oh, okay, never mind.
So the album was released in 69, and it was certified platinum in 86.
Yes. There we go. That's right. I got confused because I saw Born for Bjork. And that was
fair enough.
All right, 1997, on November 21st, Coolio and seven members of his band, The Thieves?
40 Thieves.
The 40 Thieves are arrested and charged with theft. I mean, that just makes sense. And assault in a boutique in the town of Böblingen, Germany. The eight are charged with assaulting a female clerk in a clothing store and stealing clothing worth $2,000.
Do you remember this being in the news?
I don't. I honestly don't remember this at all.
I don't either. Probably because, like, a year later, Coolio and his son were both arrested and charged for, like, the same thing.
Oh, yeah. So Coolio and Coolio Jr.?
Yeah. But so this one is kind of like a weird story because Coolio says, like, okay, so me and my band showed up to this boutique clothing store because they came down and invited us when we were on like a daytime. They were on like a daytime TV show, you know? So they're on, you know, Germany Today. And some boutique owner.
Yeah,
like,
it's Germany Today.
That was terrible. But I'll let you get away with it. They show up and they're like, yeah, you know, why don't you come down to our boutique? And he's like, sure. And then he gets down there and they have a table set up for him and pens. And the boutique owner wants them to sign autographs for customers.
Oh, nice.
Right? Like, apparently that night she'd gone out and just like made a banner and told everyone that Coolio and the 40 Thieves are going to be there. And then, so Coolio was like, no, they gave us some clothes and maybe some of my... So maybe some of the guys with me might have taken a couple extra things because they were pissed that they were there. And like, they never agreed to sign autographs. They just showed up. And then when they tried to, like, leave the store, the owner tried to block their exit. So apparently somebody punched her. So he was eventually...
As one does.
So officially, he was convicted in Germany of accessory to simple robbery.
Oh, nice.
And paid.
His defense wasn't, she was German, and therefore I thought German women could take it.
That might have worked out better. That probably would have worked
out
better.
As we all know, German women are strong.
Yes. They have a hearty constitution and a strong chin. No. Everyone knows that the strongest chins are in Irish women.
Let's go ahead and move on to November 22nd. I only found one for this day. And Jake did not find any, but I found one that I was kind of surprised Jake missed. Goes a little something like this. 1950. Born on this day, Stephen Van Zandt. Now, you may remember Stevie Van Zandt, the guitarist with Southside Johnny, then Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and Little Stephen and the Disciples of Soul. He created the music industry activist group Artists United Against Apartheid. And as an action against the Sun City Resort in South Africa. Springsteen, U2, Bob Dylan, and Run DMC all collaborated on Sun City. And, of course, Stephen Van Zandt is also an actor and has gone on to star in things like The Sopranos and a couple of other things. But he's also a fan, or he was on one of your shows that you loved, Lilyhammer.
Yes.
You were like, you were into that show.
Yeah, I still love that show.
So there you go.
Have you seen the new show that came out from the same production company that has a lot of the same Norwegian actors?
I have not.
Oh, it's insanity. I think it's called, it might just be called Vikings.
Well, the Vikings another show.
No. It's called Norsemen.
Norsemen.
It's called Norsemen. And it's like a satirical take on Vikings.
Oh, nice.
Right? Like, so in the very first episode, there's a guy who gets challenged to a fight by another guy.
Yeah.
And he's like questioning society and the laws of going like, so if I don't fight him, he gets all my things. And if I fight him and he kills me, he still gets all my things. How does this work for me? Like what? Like, this is terrible. Why should I accept? No, you can't do that. And the guy's like, look, man, society has provided an upladder for people who are physically strong. And it's nothing against you, but I'm going to take advantage of it. The show's amazing. I think there's only 4 or 5 episodes. But you have to watch it.
I definitely will. I'll give it a shot. Let's go ahead and move on, though, because that's the only one we had for November 22nd.
It's
happy birthday, Stephen
Van Zandt.
Good stuff. Sorry about that. But we are moving on to November 23rd, and this one hits close to home for me. 1951, born on this day, is Adam Krock.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there. That's the dumbest thing you've ever said.
It's a little
This is home to me, my father's birthday.
Adam Krock, of course, was born and raised in, I don't think he was born, but he was raised in East St. Louis and became well known as a front man for a group there. He always talks about how he played with the band The Urge, even though it's not the current version of The Urge in St. Louis, but he still played for a band called The Urge. later on, went on to form the band Mercy's Child with the co-founder Lou Bradbury. And, of course, has had several albums and what I would call numerous hits, because those are the ones that people always really want to hear. Great songs like Bring Jordan, This Is My Determined Purpose, and Ain't No Rock. All very good songs. I have played on a couple of those albums doing random percussion or whatever, and I love my dad's band. But it is my dad's birthday, and he is 66 years old. On Thanksgiving Day.
Oh, happy birthday, Mr. Krock.
Happy birthday, Dad.
We love you. Tell
we
Lou
do.
And tell Lou I said hi. I need to come out.
Next time I see her, I haven't seen her in a while. So
I haven't been out to a show in a while. I haven't seen Lou for a couple of years. I need to swing by and say hi.
If you like the Mercy's Child Facebook page, like they're posting stuff when they go
out
and play. And
I know.
They usually play like different places in like South County and like... I mean, they play a bunch of different places.
Here's the thing. Your dad always picks dates where I'm also planning to get really drunk. And I would love to go to your dad's show, but they don't sell beer at most of the venues he plays at.
That is true.
Yes.
So, Dad, pick a venue that serves beer, and Jake will be
there. Oh, I will be there. I'll be the first one in, the last one out.
But seriously, if you guys are listening to this and you want to check out a good Christian band in the St. Louis area, listen to Mercy's Child. There's a bunch of videos of them on YouTube and stuff like that, of them just rocking out. Just a hearty Christian rock band that has a ton of power behind them. So
Thunderthroat.
Thunderthroat Krock.
Hey, who? They're good. It's What's-His-Face still playing guitar with them?
Rich Daniels, yes.
Ah, yeah.
Rich is one of the best guitar players I've ever seen in my life, and I love watching him play. And I'm not saying that like as in, you know, well, it's Christian music. I'm like literally, He is one of the best guitar players I've ever seen in my life.
Also has a guitar rig for every group he plays with. Like, no joke. I sat down and talked to him about equipment one day and like his just approach to guitar. And that guy literally has a rig for every band he's in. He's like, I always work it down. It takes me a couple of years, but I get it fine. I find out what I'm going for with it and make a choice. I'm like, oh, good on you, dude, because it sounds amazing. Anyhow.
All right, Jake, you got the next one, and you said this was going to be a big one. So
this is probably going to be your favorite story of the day.
Let's go for it.
Which is saying something when they're cannibals were the leadoff.
That's true.
Right. So, 1976, Jerry Lee Lewis is arrested outside of Elvis Presley's Graceland mansion after waving a pistol around on the same night his father, Elmo Lewis, is arrested for drunk driving.
Nice.
So, Jerry Lee Lewis, previously on November 22nd at around 4 o'clock in the morning, drove up to Elvis Presley's Graceland mansion and talked to a guard outside the guard shack.
Yes.
At Elvis's driveway.
Yes.
And he said, hey, wife in tow, by the way, in his Cadillac.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, buddy, I'm here to see Elvis. And the guard said, well, you know, it's kind of late. Big guy's sleeping. You know, might come back tomorrow. And Jerry said, no problem. And he peeled out of Elvis's driveway, drove about 4 blocks, and rolled his Cadillac.
Wow.
All right. So, November 23rd, he shows up again sometime around 3 a.m.
Yeah.
3 a.m. in a brand new Lincoln Continental.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulls up and he says, hey, man, I'm here to see the king. He gave me a call earlier. And he's like, well, you know, the big guy's in bed right now. We don't really want to wake him up. And then he looks over and sees that he's got a Derringer sitting on the dashboard of the car. And he says, hey, what's going on with the Derringer there, Jerry? He goes, me? I'm here to shoot Elvis in the head. And the guard says, well, I think you need to leave before I call the cops. And then Jerry loses his fucking mind. Because apparently, in Jerry Lee Lewis has said, he's not crazy, and everyone should know he's joking when he says he's there to shoot Elvis in the head.
Yes.
So, he throws a fit, and the guard calls Elvis. Elvis is like, maybe I'll go out there. And everyone's like, no! No! Don't you dare go out there. We're calling the cops. And they call the cops, and the cops show up. And Jerry's sitting in the car. And a cop comes over and opens the door. And the Derringer falls out of Jerry's lap onto the ground. So the cop shuts the door so that Jerry can't get out of the car to get it. And he's really drunk. Crazy drunk.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So they arrest him. Run him down in, and then 7 o'clock in the morning, a wrecker tow truck, for those who aren't in the, tow truck driving lingo like I am, shows up to collect Jerry's Lincoln Continental, and 5 minutes later, Jerry's dad comes rolling up with a friend of his, and he goes and talks to the guard, knows him by name, he's there all the time, right? Jerry Lee Lewis and his dad are friends of Elvis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, hey, you're not going to believe what I just heard. And the guard's like, what's that? And he's like, some reporter lady just came looking for me at a different jail and told me my son's locked up at another jail. He goes, what's going on with the car over here? And then he tells him the story of what his son did like 3 hours ago. And then Elmo Lutz is like, all right, well, I'll see you later because I got to skip on my bail and not show up to court today. Later that weekend, what did Jerry Lee Lewis do? Did not go to court after going out on bail over this shit.
Wow.
Man. So, hey, like father, like son, man.
Apparently. That's pretty good.
It's such an insane story. It was hard for me to pick, like, whose perspective I want to tell the story from. I decided the guard was the best one to go with.
That works for me. Oh, man. Hey, Jake.
Yes.
We're going to have a pretty short show this week.
Good.
But that's fine. I'm cool with this. That'll work with me. Because, it gives the people a chance to enjoy more of their Thanksgiving weekend because we know that they will not eat food to listen to our show because that's how cool we are. But let's go ahead and move on to our final day this week, November 24th. And this is a good one.
Yes,
this
is
a real good one.
Yes, it
1941, bass guitarist, my favorite bass guitarist of that era, Donald Duck Dunn, is born in Memphis, Tennessee. Of course, he would later on go to be involved with Stax Records, and he would be a member of Booker T and the MGs, and he would play on just hundreds of albums, and of course, star in two Blues Brothers movies, and endear himself to a young kid growing up in Southern Illinois in those movies. Love Donald Duck Dunn. The fascinating, fascinating character. His dad, of course, gave him the nickname Duck while they were watching cartoons together featuring the popular Donald Duck. So there you go. Anything to add?
Yeah. Who was Stax Records?
That was in Memphis with Stax Records. And they had, well, I mean, Booker T and the MGs, they had just a ton of other artists, too, that are very well known. Let me look up the list.
Well,
what
I'm getting at is that Stax Record had their own group of in-house musicians.
Yes.
That competed with Memphis.
Well, Memphis is where they were. Nashville. Or Motown.
Competed with Motown.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, they definitely competed with Motown. They also competed with Muscle Shoals, and they competed with anything in Nashville and, like, tons of stuff. But, I mean, it's like, I'm trying to find some of their original group lineups and stuff, but there's just so many. So many. It's kind of stupid. Yep, I can't even. Of course, I mean, they had Otis Redding, which is one of the massive ones.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is that Motown had their own super group of session artists.
Yes.
Right. And Stax Records had their super group of session artists.
Yes.
Which was?
Which included Donald Duck Dunn, Steve the Colonel Cropper, Booker T, and, oh, who is the drummer they had? They had one, like, just stupid good drummer. I'm blanking now. He also played on Booker T and the MGs. Boop, 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 boop. Let me look it up real quick. I am blanking here. Let's see here. They had a couple of different drummers throughout their time, but yeah. I mean, Booker T was a massive part of it. Okay, Alan Jackson Jr. Al Jackson Jr. That's who it was. Man, I am coughing up a storm right now, Jake.
Yes.
So what were you going on about then?
I was getting on the Wrecking Crew.
Oh, okay. What about, okay, the Wrecking Crew, which was out west in California.
Right.
Okay.
No, so, you had the Wrecking Crew, you had Motown's group, which was
the Funk Brothers.
The Funk Brothers, right.
Then you had Stax, which they didn't have a name as far as I know.
Right, they were just Stax Records.
And then in Muscle Shoals, they had the Swampers.
Mm-hmm.
And then out in, like, Philadelphia, they had another, like, super group, which played with all of those dudes, too, so.
Yeah, yeah, jazz guys.
Like, they played with the OJs and that, and basically were the foundation of funk and disco. So, there you go. I like that.
That's all I wanted, was the name drop.
I get it. Nice.
All right, but Donald Duck Dunn shares a birthday.
Oh, yes, he does.
Mm-hmm.
Shares a birthday with one of my favorites, Pete Best.
There you go.
1941, Pete Best, the original drummer for the Beatles, was born in Delhi, India.
That right there, I guess it just his old man was in the army?
I don't know if it was an army thing, if it was something else, but he just happened to be there when he was born. Of course, he would later go on to be kicked out of the Beatles and replaced by Ringo Starr, but Pete Best still goes down in history for being the fifth Beatle from the originals. So there you go. I get it. Go ahead and go on to the next one, Jake.
Ooh, so a little bit of a sad day. Well, you want the sad one first and then go out on the happy one?
Yeah, let's do the sad one and then go out on the happy one, I guess. No, switch that. Let's do the happy one and then go out on the sad one.
Okay. It's on the same day. So, here we go. Let's do the happy one. 1991, Cyndi Lauper marries actor David Thornton. Anne, who presides over their wedding, the ordained minister himself, Little Richard.
The man.
Yes. I cannot think of any better officiant than Little Richard, regardless of what kind of wedding you want.
Yeah.
A Little Richard wedding is the best.
Yeah, it is. That is a pretty good person to have as your minister to perform the wedding. So, of course, he also performed at the reception.
Yes, he. I mean, there you go.
That's just a given.
It's
though.
Just once he gets up in front of a microphone, what are you going to tell the guy he can't sing?
If there's a piano there, he's playing it.
That's true.
Yes.
If there are sequins there, he's wearing them.
But let's go ahead and close out this little show with a sad day in music history. 1991, the frontman for Queen, Freddie Mercury, dies of AIDS-related bronchial pneumonia in Kensington, London, England, at the age of 45.
Yes.
A very, very sad day for Queen and music in general. But it wasn't until a bit later on, though, that Queen really actually like made it into the
zeitgeist.
The zeitgeist. Yes, that's a great way to put it. So it wasn't later on, they ended up getting a couple of songs played in movies. And then there was that famous scene in Wayne's World where they're listening to the song and headbanging. And it launched Queen into like a much bigger stratosphere of the music world. And now they are making a biopic about Freddie Mercury. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how that is done, because it's been in the making for a while. And Queen is, you know, very finicky about everything involving the Queen, like name and structure and everything. So, it's been a long time coming, and I'm really happy that they're at least filming that movie now, and I'm looking forward to when that one actually comes out. But Freddie Mercury was a powerhouse singer, amazing vocalist, just. He was rock and opera and a bunch of stuff, like, all together. Just a fascinating rock and roll person. And he was really missed, especially because the death was sudden. Because they didn't announce that he had AIDS until, like, the day before he died.
Well, yes and no.
Now, people who had seen him knew that there was something wrong with him.
Well, the British tabloids have been talking about it.
Yes.
For like 5 years.
Yes, it was definitely rumored that was the case. But I mean, if you saw footage of him, you knew something was wrong with him. Like, either he had cancer or he had AIDS or something along those lines. Like, you cannot look at footage of him in the last year.
Yeah.
And not think, oh my goodness, like, there's something very, very wrong here. But do you know what the last song was that he recorded?
No, I don't.
So there's a lovely story that goes along with this. They were recording the last album that Freddie Mercury was actually on. And he was having trouble singing the part. And so Brian May goes in there and asks him, "Do you want to take a break?" And he goes, "No, I can sing it, darling." And then proceeds to do in one take, "The Show Must Go On," which is like one of the great epic closing songs for that band. It's just completely over the top, and he just like nailed it. And this is like in full-blown AIDS, like having all sorts of issues and stuff, and he just went out there and just rocked it. And so that was, to me, a great story that shows you exactly how cool he was as a person, that even when his body's being completely destroyed and shutting down, he can still go out there and sing like his heart out for the song, "The Show Must Go On." And that's exactly what Queen has done after that. So there you go. That's all I got. Anything to yourself to add there, Jake?
No, sir.
All right. Like I said, it's going to be a short show. We're topping out at about 50 minutes right about now. I'm going to cough. And wanted to, of course, say, if you want to help out the show, you can do so by helping by going to our website and clicking on that Amazon banner, or going to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. I want to thank lineupmedia.fm for, of course, allowing us to do the show, and all of the great work that they do. If you want to check out some of the other great podcasts, go to lineupmedia.fm and choose anything on that list, and you will probably find something you will like. So, I have been your coughing host, Brian Kroc, on Follow the Sound. Along with me has been my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Call me Ishmael.
Okay, Ishmael. And remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.